Hello and welcome to Occupied Thoughts, a podcast brought to you by the Foundation for Middle East Peace. I'm Peter Beinart, non-resident fellow at FMEP. I'm here with Steve Simon, who is a visiting professor of practice at the Jackson School for International Studies at the University of Washington and a former senior director at the National Security Council for the Middle East and North Africa in the Obama administration from 2011 to 2012. And I'm really grateful that Steve was willing to spend a few minutes talking to me, someone I've had the pleasure of knowing for quite a few years, to kind of talk about how he's now analyzing the Biden administration's policy making on this crisis in Gaza and Israel, given that he was in these rooms where these kind of policies were being made. So, Steve, thanks so much for doing this.
Pleasure is all mine, Peter.
So I just want to start with a really broad question. Many of us look at the outside and we have our, in my case, a lot of frustrations and criticisms of the Obama of the Biden administration's policy since this war broke out, but we don't know what it's actually like to be in the policymaking process. So I wonder if you can just talk about, given that you have that lens of trying to understand what it's like to make policy on Israel-Palestine, how does that inform how you see the way they've behaved since this war broke out?
Let me start with an anecdote. It's a minor one, and I haven't discussed it before because it is so minor. But I was in the I was in the Oval Office with Obama and Joe Biden, and it was just us three, really. And Biden asked what our strategy was, towards Israel. And I guess the peace process was, more or less what he had in mind. And I
This was
said,
2011, 2012. This was,
and
Obama's first term.
I don't remember exactly when. And so I said, actually, we don't have a strategy as such. I said, what we have is an approach that is like hopping lily pads. We hop from one lily pad to another and hope not to fall in the water. And Biden really lost his cool, because he was under the impression, that we had a strategy. And Obama was he just took it in stride, and
Maybe
he
this is
took
why you're no longer in government, Steve.
and he turned to me and he said, "Well, Steve, what Joe wants to know is whether we have a sort of a systematic strategy, for this, rather than what I've laid out there." And then the discussion deteriorated from there, because we didn't really have a strategy. I mean, it would with Israel, it is kind of a lily pad hopping thing. I mean, we need to try to keep Israel on the straight and narrow. We can discuss what that means, but I mean, we and maintain our commitments to Israel, and we have both written and intangible commitments and political commitments that are quite important. So we try and do those, while ensuring that those commitments don't run against the grain of our broader strategic approach to the region. So that's sort of how we tend to do it. I think that's pretty much been the Biden administration's approach, but not but not entirely. Over time, I think the administration, in the course of its first year and a half, had slowly developed what I suppose one consider a real strategy towards Israel, which was, of course, very bold. And now,
And what was that?
w at a minimum, it's now on the shelf because of Gaza.
You mean that was the normalization with the Saudis?
The normalization with the Saudis, which the administration thought would have a number of salutary effects if all the pieces fell into place. So, I mean, in that respect, the Biden administration differed from the Obama administration, and in fact, previous administrations. Yeah, going back to really going back to the very end of Clinton's first term. Oh, yeah, Clinton's second term, rather. Anyway, that's.
So when you say the policy is to keep Israel on the straight and narrow, but as long, so long as they don't disrupt America's larger strategic approach, is it too cynical to basically say what that sounds like to me is Israel can do whatever the hell they want to the Palestinians as long as it doesn't basically screw up our relationships with some of the, you know, some of the governments in the Middle East that we think matter?
Well, I wouldn't put it in, exactly those words, maybe because I spent too long at government. It corrupts discourse, as you well know. But I think let me kill this. Pardon me. Look, I think the Palestinian problem is not a strategic problem for the United States. It's a desideratum, though. The United States would like to see a two-state solution. That's its policy, and it has been for a long time and for good reason. So it's important to the United States,
But can I push back? I mean, is it really important to the United States, and is it really our policy? Because I understand it's our stated policy. I mean, my stated policy might be I'd like to lose 15 pounds. But I mean, if you look at what the US has been doing, certainly under the Biden administration, I mean, it's basically before October 7th, it was basically seemed to me like support Israel pretty much no matter what it does, even as Israel's making a two-state solution less likely. Is that really our policy?
Well, there was a great historian. No, I think he was a political scientist, Yehoshafat Hakabi. He's an Israeli. He was head of DMI, the military intelligence, quite a legendary figure in Israel. And anyway, he abandoned his military career, got a political science PhD, I think it was at Harvard. And he wrote a really interesting book, where he differentiated between program and agenda. Basically, states have a program and they have an agenda, and the one might stipulate for there was a Cold War context to this book. So I mean, one might stipulate there's only room for one system on this planet, and it's liberal capitalism, and. It's liberal capitalism, and the other system, the competing system, has to go. It's just the globe can't accommodate both. But on the other hand, your actual day-to-day policy is not if n really untethered, from that from your overall posture. So you negotiate with this other party representing, embodying this other system. You accommodate to their presence. You make arms control deals with them. And you structure a strategic context underpinned by deterrence, which is a form of bargaining. So it's part of a bargaining process, as it were. So my answer to your question is, well, governments do this all the time, and they do it on a really large scale. I mean, you have a policy, you have preferred outcomes that might be unachievable, because after all, we can't, for the with respect to the Palestinians, the United States can't do it. It's in Israel's hands. We could try and influence Israel to the best of our possibility, but the U.S.-Israel relationship is a very peculiar one because of Israel's traction in American domestic politics, and it's a traction that that's unique, really, and they are absolutely merciless in the way that that they use that traction to affect policy outcomes. But the fact is, when it comes to strategic things, I'll give you a couple of examples. Well, I'll just give you one example, from when I was at the NSC under Obama. The Israelis, as we know, thought that the best the best approach to the problem of Iran's nuclear aspirations was to attack Iran militarily and destroy its nuclear infrastructure. But they couldn't do that themselves without assistance from the United States, and their preference was for the United States simply to do it, because the U.S. was in a position militarily to do it without it really even breathing hard, where for the Israelis it was a stretch. So they did a full court press to get the US to do this, but the US simply refused and just said, well, no, we're not going to do it. Our preferred approach is negotiations. We've begun negotiations, and we're going to continue them, and we're going to see how far they can get, and we're not going to muddy the waters or stanch the possibility of negotiation by attacking Iran at this point. We're not ruling it out. Could happen in the future, but not now. And the Israelis were deeply unhappy about that. But it was a strategic issue for the United States, in the sense that politics was not going to be allowed to intrude upon it.
Right. And do you think, so one of the questions, big questions about the Biden administration is, since October 7th, is could they have pushed the edges of the limits of what the politics in America will bear in terms of this war, or not? And I'm curious, one way of thinking about that for me is, what would Obama have done in the same circumstances? You hung out with both of them. Do you think their instincts were different? Do you think Obama might have responded differently in the wake of October 7th than Biden has?
Yes, that is one of those fascinating counterfactuals. And honestly, I just can't say. I just can't say, because it would depend, first of all, on when. I mean, it in Obama's first term, I think, he would have done very much what Biden did. In his second term, he might have acted differently. In part because he would have been, I mean, just in terms of general principles, he would have been a second term president. So, not worried about re-election, just having a freer hand, for that reason alone. And secondly, because his views of Israel's politics and its leaders, not Israel as a country, per se, but his views towards the government, I think had really soured. And he would have at that point had far less confidence in the influence that a close embrace would conceivably have achieved. So he would have been much more skeptical, I think, than Biden was going into this, where, I mean, if you look at Biden's remarks, they're very interesting because they do combine, this close embrace, which has been, heavily criticized, at least from one side, of the argument, with strong points about the need to adhere to international law, not go to extremes, maintain a sense of proportionality, and as Biden put it in one of his speeches, and not turn into the enemy. Biden's point to the Israelis was, well, there's something that differentiates us, the United States and Israel and other, democracies from Hamas, this implacable enemy we're facing, and that's an adherence to certain standards. And so these two themes were always combined. But anyway, going back to Obama, I think by the second term, he might have taken steps to cut off the flow of munitions that Biden has not done.
And do you think that's because Biden's just in a different political situation? Again, he is a first-term president. Or do you think it's also just that Biden, I mean, one of the critiques of Biden was not, I mean, most of it was about the policy, that basically he was supporting this catastrophic war, but that also he just didn't seem to have a lot of empathy for Palestinians. I mean, he seemed to feel the plight of Israeli Jews kind of viscerally in a way he just didn't. So do you think, how much do you think it's because that difference is Biden's a different political situation? How much was he's just a different guy with a different life experience than Obama?
So the latter point is extremely important, I think, in understanding Biden. There's a vast generational difference. There's just been a sea change, really, between the era in which Biden matured as a person and as a politician, and Obama, and their life experience is much different. Anyway, that they're very much not the same people. Okay, so and Biden's sense of Israel, and the attitudes he brought to the U.S.-Israeli relationship were from a different era. And I think he felt them really, really deeply. This is from an era when Israel were the cowboys, and Palestinians were the Indians, and they were
Yeah,
fighting.
with all of that, all that's encoded in that those kind of racialized frames.
Yeah, very much so. So I so I think that's just Biden and he's a synecdoche, really, of a certain generation. Yeah, and Biden and Obama was not part of that generation. So I think that's important, okay, in understanding Biden's response, to October 7th. But there's another aspect which is important to bear in mind when you're evaluating, his response to October 7th, which is the typical impulse of an administration in a crisis involving Israel would be, look, we need to come out very strongly on their side, rhetorically, materially, or whatever, because the resolution of the crisis, whatever the crisis is going to require concessions by Israel that the United States will have to force. So the important thing to do is at the outset of the crisis is to build up as much capital as possible with the Israeli public and with the Israeli government, because that's all going to become important. It's going to have to be spent later on in enforcing a resolution to the crisis of the moment. And you could see that playing out so clearly in the Biden administration's response to this crisis.
Right. I can see people telling themselves that, but do you buy it in the sense that, like, I don't, I, or is that just a rationalization for the fact that the politics of not coming out four square for Israel's war would have been in Washington would have been a disaster politically for him? But, like, what kind, I mean, as we look at things, has Biden actually gained any credibility with Netanyahu, or for that matter, even Israeli Jews in general, that has given him the ability to do anything? It seems like mostly he's just kind of in a passive aggressive kind of way been asking for them to do something different for a while now. And they in the government, with the support of a lot of Israelis, have seemed very comfortable saying no.
It's funny because in one of the things that I've written since October 7th, for publication, I've described, Israel's, I've described the Biden administration's approach to Israel in the first year and a half of the administration as passive aggressive. I think that's an apt term. But anyway, no, I think they really do believe it. It's not just,
A rationalization.
A tactic or a rationalization, for a tactic that's being forced entirely by U.S. domestic politics. So the U.S. domestic politics are obviously a factor in thinking, in the administration's thinking. So that's inescapable. But I think it's more than a rationalization, because it was clear at the outset from this crisis that there was going to have to be some kind of politically tractable outcome, and it would be one that the Israelis would fight, at least on one level. But on the other, once the Israelis kind of understood, in this model, okay, once the Israelis understood that, oh, they're really going to have to make some, concessions that would run counter to all their government's rhetoric until, a certain point, the U.S. pressure becomes cover, for the Israeli government to do what it understands it really needs to do, but is politically difficult for them to do at that point. So, they can, direct, the blame to, the United States, which is forcing them to do things, and because the United States is a big bad uncle.
Right. But is there, do you get the sense that there are people in the Israeli government who actually would like to end the, I mean, ending the war now means that you haven't quote unquote destroyed Hamas. You think that there's that Netanyahu or other people in the Israeli government would actually like to do that and are kind of happy that the US might give them some cover for that? Or it doesn't seem, I mean, I'm curious.
Well, Netanyahu talks about, nitzachon muchlat, which is like, absolute victory. I think he's very serious about that. And I think a lot of his, although there are some divisions within the cabinet, within the war cabinet that we've seen on certain issues, I kind of think that, they're all behind that. But I think that the broader, answer to your question here is that, this Israeli government is different, from previous Israeli governments, and not just, in a matter of degree. I think it's different in kind. There's been an evolution in Israeli politics, which has been playing out for a long time, and at some point it gives it, it you know the evolution results in the emergence of a new species, to speak in
And
Pascal
what's the difference
Darwinian
as it relates
terms.
to the U.S.-Israel relationship?
Oh, I think it's problematic.
You mean you're saying that the people there's less U.S. influence because those people just are so ideologically extreme that they're not on the same page as they're not even on the same remotely the same page as the U.S. administration.
It's the differences, I think, are profound. Now, I mean, to some extent, there's always been this, counter-cyclical, aspect to the U.S.-Israeli relationship, where they have a right-wing government when the United States has a Democratic president, and so you get a lot of turbulence. You can sort of see that if you look back over the history of the relationship, and it's like that now, but much worse. And the U.S., in terms of its strategy towards Israel at this point, and it does have a strategy, or at least it did, was to try and stem this devolution in Israeli politics, using the U.S. Using Saudi normalization as a lever. And it wasn't a bad idea, actually. But you have this part of the Israeli coalition, the religious right part of the coalition. They don't really care about Saudi normalization. I mean, for them, control over the landmass of biblical Israel is a lot more important than some Israelis getting rich off Saudi Arabia. It's like, not their thing.
The thing which I find so kind of odd about this argument is that we need to give the, we need to have the prospect, dangle the prospect of Saudi normalization, so then we'll have some leverage over Israel to get them to do what we want, right? I mean, it's not as if the US doesn't have other points of leverage. We're giving them these weapons that they're using to fight the war. We're protecting them with the United Nations. We're protecting them in all kinds of international institutions. Like, we have lots of leverage, it seems to me, even without the Saudi normalization thing. So why not just use that?
So, there are two schools of thought. There's the one that you've eloquently laid out, which is that there's all this leverage the United States can use, and it just doesn't use it. And there's this other school of thought, which is the are you kidding? Way of looking at this. Withholding the flow of 155 millimeter shells, for self-propelled artillery, and some lower caliber shells that are being transferred as tank ammunitions, because the Israeli expenditure rates have been really incredible compared to what the United States would be doing in a similar conflict. That leverage is so trivial that it's a laugh. So the effect would be only symbolic, and if the effect is going to be purely symbolic and not actually affect Israeli behavior, except to force them to be more disciplined in their to exercise a greater fire discipline. Well, why put up with the political uproar that cutting this flow of munitions off would spur? I mean, it wouldn't seem very logical. I mean, the kind of leverage that would get the Israelis to stop, is not leverage that's really available to the United States. It's not in the U.S. It's not in the U.S. quiver. You know, we just don't have that.
I
So,
mean, we could, we could, couldn't we impose sanctions on Israeli government ministers? I mean, we could, I'm just talking, I'm talking about things that are not, I mean, it's, we could support the, we could tell them that we're going to, that whatever the International Criminal Court decides or the International Court of Justice decides, we'll get behind that. We could create a situation where it would be dangerous for any Israeli government minister to come to the United States or to come to Europe because they'd get arrested. I mean, given the level of war crimes that a lot of people think they're committing. I mean, I guess I don't really understand the idea that we don't have leverage. I mean, I understand we might not want to use it, but
Well, I think the steps that you're talking about, they don't work on other countries when we do them. And if they don't work on these other countries where we sanction, particular individuals and so forth, I don't see why they would work
but those are
on here.
adversaries, aren't they? I mean, it's a little different when you're doing it with the country that is, as you say, your little brother. I mean, it's not, then that would be a earthquake for Israel geopolitically, because we're the country they look to protect us, in all these international forums from, to ensure their impunity for their actions. It's not the same as doing it to Russia or Iran, is it?
But when you do it, you transform Israel into Russia or Iran. And I, it, you know, you and the US isn't going to do that because Israel isn't Russia or Iran. Certainly in the US imagination, and not really Russia or Iran in any kind of practical sense. So the U.S. is just it's not going to transform, Israel into those adversaries, turn Israel into an enemy by virtue of these steps that one typically takes towards enemies. They're not going to do it. I mean, Israel is doing something, I think, really excessive, in Gaza. And there's no question that the United States believes that because the United States has said that. The president has said it, and other administration officials, have said it. And so, that's already out there. And the Israelis who care about the bilateral relationship are already worried. I mean, the signals the U.S. has sent are very clear. They're abundantly clear. But at this stage, for Netanyahu, these signals are extremely helpful. And that's the bind, that the United States is in right now, because Netanyahu is running essentially against Biden, hoping to run out the clock, in the sense that there's an election coming up in November, which isn't all that far away. Donald Trump has a shot at winning that election, and if he does, then Biden will have proved to be just a road bump for Netanyahu. And that's it. And the United States' stance right now, for the religious right and for Netanyahu's use, rhetorically, in the context of an upcoming election, should one take place, or in the effort to delay infinitely, at least for the next 3 years, an election, which would be his preferred strategy. What the U.S. is doing validates a narrative of Israeli isolation, burgeoning anti-Semitism that just emerges. It's this conflict has ripped the nice mask off an ugly America that's fundamentally anti-Semitic, and and all this stuff, and it's that's useful to him. I mean, it's unavoidable. You can't you still have to say what it is you have to say. So, and Israel is deeply divided. But the thing is that the people who are seriously worried about the state of the U.S.-Israeli relationship, are not the majority, and they're not in power, and they haven't been able to to coalesce as a political force in years. So it's a difficult situation.
So my last question is just you having you were you know you were staffer at the NSC. There has been one guy from the State Department, this guy Josh Paul, who resigned. And I mean, I know that I just wonder, in your experience, if you think how many people think in those terms. I mean, that I understand, I mean, in the sense that you could look, I look at this situation and I think the International Court of Justice has said it's plausible that this is a genocide. There are some scholars who think it is actually deserves that term. Even if it's not a genocide, it's one of the largest slaughters of our time and one of the fastest famines, human-made famines. So do you think people, and I just sometimes wonder, maybe I'm so far away from this that I don't understand, but I do wonder, like, do people think to themselves, like, do I want to really have to answer for being part of this for the rest of my life? And I just, do you think that people think in those terms? Or do you think that's just somehow, that's not the mindset of people who are working day to day in the grind of government?
Okay, so I have a sort of a two-part response to this, so bear with me. The first is that I'm from another generation, okay, and the distance, I think, psychologically, cognitively, temperamentally, I mean, between certainly myself as I was in 2011 and 12, or even myself as I am now, and the younger cohort that staffs positions, particularly at the State Department, the gap is vast. Okay, and I see that on campuses. I mean, I teach, so and so there's my attitudes, towards work and policy and civil service and all that are quite different, I think, to this younger cohort, and there's which is why, when I look at these open letters and so forth, and Josh Paul's resignation, which I do respect, actually, I'm just, I don't know if I'm alienated, but it's, I do wonder, well, I do wonder about the values that now seem to prevail, at least among people working in the U.S. government, younger.
Why? Because you feel like basically the idea of government is that once you don't make the policy, and whatever the policy is, your job is to just implement, and that's the end of it, or?
Well, yeah, sure. And the government, it's supposed to be responsive to the president,
But then, but couldn't you then say, yes, president makes the decisions, but if I can't live with myself, then the right thing to do is to resign.
yes, I absolutely, which is why I respect Josh Paul's resignation. I think he put his money where his mouth was, and And that's how it should be. And I, obviously he's a person with great integrity. So there's, and that's quite impressive to me, to me personally. All the, all the, letters without signatures and conversations with reporters where, the person says, well, I can't disclose my name because I might be fired, for saying this is I don't have quite the respect, for that as I do for Josh, Paul. But I think, when you're inside, you have a job to do, and you do it, and that's what it means to be, in the civil service. So that's one part of the answer. Okay. The other part is it goes to, the nature of this particular conflict, this particular round in the longstanding war between Israel, between, Jews and Arabs in Palestine. Okay, this has been a 100-year war, as Rashid Khalidi is, he's sort of popularized.
Although he called it 100 years war on Palestine, slightly different framing, but I hear you, but certainly talking about 100 years.
Yeah, well, I think yes, but it's really, it's a contest between two communities, and it always has been. And this latest round, has been sort of complicated by the way it started, by the way it began. And if I think, the Biden administration, has to take that into account. And in fact, it should take it into account. Okay, the October 7 attack on Israel was unbelievably sadistic. And to expect Israel, not to respond is completely absurd. And you and I both know a lot of Israelis, and I saw it, but I don't know if your experience would be different than the one I contemplate when I ask myself, okay, if I went to one of my Israeli friends,
Jewish Israeli friends.
Jewish Israeli friends,
You went to Palestinian citizens of Israel, it would be different, probably.
well, if I went, yeah, so if I went, but I know quite a number of those too, and let's just talk about the Jews. So if I went to one of my Jewish Israeli friends on October 6, and I said, let's postulate a Hamas attack against Israel, it's really horrific, that kills like 1,000 people, or more. Let's talk about what the appropriate response would be. And I would say, okay, so option A is that Israel kills 30,000 30,000 Palestinians, most of whom are non-combatants. How about that, for response? And I think the answer would have been, what, are you crazy? 30,000 people, that's completely insane. We would never do that. And then on October 8th, people, those same people.
Right, 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 right.
Something happened, and you and not acknowledging that, or factoring it in to the overall equation, I think is simply wrong. So the Israelis decide, okay, we're going to get rid of Hamas once and for all, and not an unreasonable reaction to the October 7 attack, and they decide to go for it, and it's really ill thought out because it all happens very rapidly,
And also
and
maybe because you can't actually get rid of Hamas.
well,
I mean,
well,
you could make them no longer running things in Gaza, but that's different from getting rid of
yes, yeah, but that very rapidly became clear as the Israeli objective. In other words, you wanted to disarm the group, render it impotent as a military organization, and decapitate it, So, and render it incapable of regulating affairs in Gaza or attacking Israel. Okay, so that was it, and it seemed like a reasonable objective, and it is a reasonable objective. But of course, the Israelis quickly learned that, well, actually, to achieve this realistic objective, you need to kill a lot of Palestinians because they're in the way. And the thing is that, in this respect, Hamas bears a huge culpability. Okay, because you're well aware that its strategy is to interpose civilians between itself and Israel.
As every guerrilla group does. I mean, that's the way the Viet Cong
I'm
fought too.
not, I'm not, I'm not singularizing.
I mean, that's just the nature of this kind of warfare.
Yeah, but that doesn't exculpate, Hamas.
I mean, we can talk about the international law of it, but I mean, that's not our conversation. But I think, I mean, it sounds to me what you're saying is that Israel's policy, in your view, is perhaps misguided, but not so objectionable that it should have led someone to contemplate, resigning from the U.S. government because of we were supporting it.
Oh, I think if you're in government, particularly in a senior position, you're going to be seeing this thing in a different way than you're seeing it.
No, I think no, I think that makes a lot of sense. I think that's exactly right. There is a different perspective that one has in government. Steve, we've been going for 50 minutes, and I should probably let you go. I know you have many other things this afternoon, but I appreciate you doing this.
Well, yeah, I think it's important to have these conversations. It's usually important, and I think your podcast, really makes a contribution. So, and I do appreciate that, and I appreciate being able to pitch in. And it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
I thank you. Thanks. I enjoy it too. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in to this episode of Occupied Thoughts. Please make sure you check out the FMEP website, fmep.org, for resources related to this podcast and lots of other rich content related to Palestine and Israel. And please make sure you're subscribed to this podcast to stay up to date. You can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Spotify. And you can also watch video versions of our podcast, including this one on YouTube. And with that, I'm Peter Beinart signing off until the next episode of FMEP's Occupied Thoughts.